no technical capacity. So I want to spend today walking you guys through the restatement second and helping you get just kind of an understanding of how courts apply this, how you might make arguments to apply the restatement second. We talked last class about Curie's theory as kind of the fundamental underpinnings of interest analysis. And from here on out, we're going to take a look at a couple of contemporary methodologies or approaches to conflicts of law. All of them, to lesser or greater extent, start with or incorporate that idea of interest analysis. So I wanted to kind of preview it for you, and now I want to actually walk through some of these different methodologies. I said this last time, I just want to remind you, as you're reading through the materials, we'll talk in here in terms of absolutes, in terms of the idea of the restatement second, in terms of Leflar's better law approach, in terms of interest analysis, as if they are like these discrete, independent theories or approaches or rules. But as you read the cases, you'll see that courts frequently kind of pick and choose and kind of meld the different theories together, sometimes say they're doing one and really do the other. Just be cognizant, as I said last time, if you're getting frustrated because of that, just be cognizant that that's what's going on. Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about the restatement second. Generally, and I think the casebook has a note that tells you this is probably the most frequent courts purport to use the restatement second the most frequently. Whether they actually use it or do something else, it's a different story. But and so I want you to have a good handle and a good understanding on how it works and how you might make arguments from it. And in part, the restatement second was meant to be an answer to what people had seen as the critique of the restatement first, although you'll see it ultimately by the time they were done, they ended up throwing in a little bit of every kind of theory that was out there floating about conflicts of law. So restatement second has a couple of things. It's basically set up, it starts from a general principle. It looks a lot like the first restatement in that it's set up according to different types of disputes. There's a section on torts, a section on contracts, a section on property, but the actual content is a little bit different. It starts, I have the tort section up by way of example. It always starts with what it calls a general principle. And it turns out it doesn't matter whether you're talking about torts or contracts or property. The general principle is always, as you see in one, which is the law of the state which has the most significant relationship to the occurrence, to the dispute, will govern. So we have a couple of things for us to do, which is first of all figure out what this term means because it's used all over the place. Start from the idea that generally speaking, the jurisdiction with the most significant relationship, that law will govern. And in each of the sections, here's the torts by way of example, the restatement second gives you a list of contacts. Here's the contacts that we think will be relevant to determining the most significant relationship. Okay, so on the one hand, kind of a departure from what we did in the first restatement. Instead of just saying, in all tort cases, we have determined that the state with the most significant relationship will be the place of injury, it actually attempts to try to give you some room for contextualization, for considering the individual facts. And so you see, the restatement tells you, at least in tort cases, the place of injury, the place where the conduct occurred, the domicile, the place where the relationship was set. Look at those court lawyers. Look at those factors and use those factors or those contacts to help you decide what is the state of the most significant relationship. Okay, then, because if you think about that, that's pretty amorphous, right? That leaves the door open for a whole lot of discussion and uncertainty about what state really has the most significant relationship. Then, what the drafters purported to do is put a little bit of predictability into the process. Because after the general principle in each of the topic areas, there's then a list of specific rules that kind of break down all the specific kinds of tort issues and contract issues that the drafters could foresee arising, and it gives you a presumptive rule. So here I've got the personal injury one. We're going to presume that in personal injury cases, the law with the most significant, the state with the most significant relationship will be the state where the event occurred, right, where the injury occurred. And then C breaks down. So we start with personal injury, law of the place of the injury. Give you another example, defamation, wherever publication occurs. And so the idea was you were getting some general rules like you had under the first restatement, but they were a little bit more specific. And just sort of, instead of saying in all tort cases it's the law of the place of the wrong, we're actually going to break it down by different types of torts and say, okay, in personal injury actions it's the place of injury, in defamation it's the place of publication, wrongful death actions, it's where the injury occurred. So that was one thing that was a little bit different. The other thing is, in all of these specific rules, they're just presumptive rules. But they always come back to the principle that ultimately, this is just a presumption, right? We presume that the law where the place of the injury happened is the law of the state with the most significant relationship. But of course, if it turns out that some other jurisdiction has a more significant relationship, then that law ought to govern. And the last thing, which is really kind of the guiding principle here is, so we have a presumptive rule. The restatement identifies a presumptive jurisdiction whose law will govern. Restatement also tells us, but if some other jurisdiction has a more significant relationship, the most significant relationship, its law should govern. And here are the contexts you should consider in defining or determining the jurisdiction with the most significant relationship. Beyond that, you're supposed to evaluate those contexts. You know, in torts, you're supposed to evaluate the place of injury, the place of conduct, the domicile of the parties, the center of relationship. Evaluate those contexts in light of what the Restatement Second calls these choice of law principles. And you're supposed to put these two things together, that list of contexts and these principles, the needs of the interstate system, the relevant policies of the forum, the policies of other interested states, the protection of justified expectations. You're supposed to put those together and somehow meld those together to come up with the answer about what's the most significant relationship. That's the framework of how this was supposed to work. So a couple of observations. It turns out that courts generally do one of two things with these things. Some courts go right to the presumptive rules and pretty much ignore everything else. It's a personal injury case. Law of the place of injury governs. And yeah, we're supposed to think about these Section 6 things, but we're just not really going to do anything with them. Many courts, like the two courts that you have, the cases you have in your casebook, do the opposite. They kind of acknowledge that those presumptive rules are out there, but then say, but ultimately, all of these presumptive rules can be overridden by the law of the state with the most significant relationship. So in order to resolve this problem, we always have to figure out what state has the most significant relationship. So who cares about the presumptive rules? We're just going to dive right in and figure out which state has the most significant relationship. Even within that, if you look and you compare side by side those two cases, you'll see what courts do with these Section 6 factors is a little bit different. They're not even consistent in the way that they handle these factors right here. So the first case you have, the O'Connor case, it's a case a lot like Babcock, which we were talking about last week. The plaintiff and the defendant, boyfriend and girlfriend at the time, subsequently end up getting married, leave from their home in Connecticut, go on a little excursion up to Canada, and get in an auto accident in Ontario. the plaintiff friend comes back and sues the defendant boyfriend for injuries she suffered in the accident. And you have this same issue again, this idea that Ontario places some limits on tort recovery. By the way, this isn't about a guest statute. Anybody pick up what the Ontario statute is that the parties are fighting about in this case? Oh, is it? I'm sorry. I'm just so used to it being Ontario, always Ontario. Apologize to any Canadians out there for my lack of proper deference and respect to your federal system. Professor Stewart, sorry. Yeah, you know, they have a system about, probably the closest equivalent the court tells us, is a workers' compensation system here, right? They have a complete administrative system of recovery by which the injured party can recover. In exchange, the right to sue the individual defendant is extinguished. Okay, so the question is about whether or not the plaintiff in this case is gonna be left to that administrative recovery system or be able to sue under the more general tort recovery like we have here, Connecticut in the case. Okay, so the court here, first of all, tells you, makes pretty quick work of the fact that it's no longer going to apply the first restatement law of the place of the wrong world. Instead, it's going to apply the second restatement, and then it goes about the business of actually trying to apply the second restatement. Okay, so I said, remember, one of the things that this does is it gives you the list of contacts that the court's supposed to consider in a tort case. So go ahead, walk through. Walk through those contacts. Where's the place of injury in this case? It's in Quebec, right? Where did the conduct at issue occur? Quebec. What about, where's the domicile of the relevant parties? And where is the relationship centered, to the extent that there's any relationship between the parties? Connecticut, right? That's where they actually start out on the journey. That's where they know each other. That's where they return. So now the trick is figuring out whether, in light of these contacts, Quebec really is the state with the most significant relationship, or if instead, Connecticut is the state with the most significant relationships. And you're supposed to do that. I mean, the idea was that the court would do that in light of these Section 6 principles. So, the needs of the interstate and international system, the relevant policies of the forum, the policies of other interested states, protection of justified expectations, basic policies underlying the field of law, certainty, predictability, uniformity, ease, and determination. When you look at the court's analysis in this case, can you find for me where the court talks about the needs of the interstate system? Can you find for me where the court talks about the ease and the determination and the application of the law to be applied? What does the court look at to reach its conclusion that Connecticut law ought to apply even though the injury occurred in Quebec? Yeah?
Just the interest of the two jurisdictions.
It looks at B and C here, right? The relevant policies of the forum, the policies of the other interested states. And let's think about that for a minute. How does the court get to the conclusion that these contacts and the relevant policies add up to the idea that Connecticut law should apply? What is the interest? Why is it that Quebec has this administrative system of compensation for victims of torts? And how is it you think it keeps insurance premiums reasonable? Well, let's explore this actually a little bit more detail. How is it or why is it that victims get compensation quicker? More quickly under an administrative system? Anybody do any work with workers' comp? And I know you guys said nobody's exposed to personal injury work yet. Why is it you think that this system might result in getting injured parties money faster? Yeah.
Like a set amount for certain injuries.
Yeah. And think about how there's a set amount. The way in which the claims are processed looks a little bit different than litigation. So a couple of things. One thing that might frequently happen in personal injury litigation is that parties dispute who's actually responsible. And they dispute how much, for how much, the extent of one's damage. One thing this does is if you don't really have a dispute about it, you don't have to take the time to fight about it. So that's part of the idea. We have a set chart about how much, and we have no real dispute about whether or not anybody's liable because the state is just going to pay out pursuant to the compensation scheme. Think about not only is it quicker, but what else might it do for the injured party? So you get the money faster because you're not waiting for your case to process through court before you get there, right? Before you ultimately get a judgment. But what else? Yeah.
Is it less stressful, less hassle?
Less stressful for sure. I always share with this, in my remedies class, we talk a little bit about personal injury damages in general, and in particular, recovery for non-economic losses, which we'll talk about with respect to the next case. And I always share this story. I had a good friend who, if ever there was someone who was a victim of a med mal case, that she really was. She and her boyfriend had gotten into a car accident, and his injuries were such that they were life-threatening at the scene. They were in a small town. They raced both of them to the nearest hospital, and everybody was so focused on his injuries, because they were life-threatening, that the radiologist in the ER missed the fact that she had broken a vertebrae, which is also a very significant injury if you're not aware. But she wasn't manifesting any symptoms. And literally, it clear as day, a med student would have seen it. He was the only person there, and he was so focused on reading the x-rays for the boyfriend, he never saw that. And her injuries progressed. She started having tingling and losing sensation. And over the course of a year, her treating physician, who was treating her injuries, kept telling her, "You're a malingerer. Stop. Leave." Finally, after about a year, she sees another physician in the practice. She goes back and sits at the desk. She's typing, and she gets a call. So-and-so. "Don't panic. Don't move quickly. Don't do anything rash. But I would like you to stand up now, walk very slowly downstairs to the lobby of the building, hail a cab, and get to the hospital. Don't drive yourself. Get to the hospital right away." They protected this thing, and it was within millimeters of 7 years. Anyway. All this to say, this is truly, in many respects, the best med mal practice case you can find if you're a plaintiff's lawyer. My friend never brought a claim. She is an attorney. She never brought a claim. And we were sitting around after the fact asking her, like, "Wow, like, how could you not?" In fact, we have a mutual friend who is a plaintiff's lawyer. He's like, "Let me take the case. This is great. We can win." And she said, "Are you kidding me? I've spent 4 years taking people's depositions and defending depositions and arguing motions for summary judgment and seeing cases where witnesses have to take the stand and in particular injured parties have to take the stand and testify." She said, "Look, at the end of the day, all of my medical expenses were covered by insurance. I suffered no debilitating damage. I'm going to recover completely.
you know, why would I ever undertake the hassle, the stress, the anxiety of litigation given these circumstances? It's just not worth it for me. So there's something to your point, right? Why is it that Quebec might do this? Well, isn't that a long way to get back to the statute, right? But there's something reason why. It gets the plaintiffs money more quickly, and if they're injured and they have medical needs, quick is important so they can get to the doctor and get treatment. It takes some of the stress and anxiety of trial off the table. Not just that, it's cheap. You don't need a lawyer, theoretically, you don't need a lawyer. To the extent that you do need a lawyer, the lawyer has less work to do because the administrative proceeding, filing the claim, involves less contested hearings and putting forth evidence and arguing motions, so that it's a cheaper way, which ultimately may be a good thing for the injured party, because ultimately, even if the injured party in our system, in litigation, recovers the full value of her medical damages, at the end of the day, she recovers it only after she's gone through a lengthy trial, so her money, she's delayed in receiving her money. Not only that, she's got to pay her lawyer out of whatever she recovers, right? So, on the one hand, you can see Quebec might do this as a way to get people money faster. On the other hand, you said something about insurance premiums. How does this help keep insurance premiums down in Quebec? Yeah. And again, that works in two respects. It brings insurance premiums down theoretically, actually kind of in three. One, we said the payout's actually lower in this compensation scheme than it might otherwise be in traditional tort recovery. So insurance companies are actually on the hook for less money, right? Beyond that, insurance companies, just like the injured parties, don't have to hire a bunch of lawyers. They don't incur transaction costs in defending the lawsuit. And so presumably that helps keep the insurance company's costs down and keeps premiums down. And then you're right, the big thing is it provides some certainty. So that insurance companies, when they underwrite policies and reserve risks, have a pretty, or reserve funds, have a pretty good idea about what their ultimate risk of exposure really is, and so that's good for everybody. The idea is this is a good trade-off for everybody. Injured parties get less money in total, but they get it more quickly, and less of that money is consumed by transaction costs. Insurance companies don't have to pay the transaction costs, have some certainty, and that keeps the premiums down. Okay, on the flip side, given that we've now just discovered the amazing benefits of having a system of socialized compensation for victims of torts, why do we not have it here? I don't know of a single state that has this outside of the context of workers' compensation. Let's march down to the Ohio House now, because clearly the Ohio legislature is not doing their job. We need to get this passed. It's a win-win. Insurance companies will be on their side. We're on their side. Yeah.
Is it just safe to say that culturally we're less amenable to those kinds of solutions?
Maybe, but what do you think? Why is it? I mean, what is the benefit we see? I think you're right. Ultimately, it's a cultural difference. But what is that, what benefit do we see? What's that cultural difference rooted in?
Well, taxpayers are kind of on the hook for tort injuries, whereas here, insurance companies, or in some cases, defendants are on the hook for tort injuries.
Well, we certainly have the theory, the sentimental romance that the defendant herself is on the hook for the injuries. Although ultimately that might get paid through insurance, that still comes out of the defendant's pocket in some way because the defendant has to pay for that insurance. And why might that be a good thing? It's not foolish. There's a principled reason why we might think it's a good idea to make the tortfeasor pay, either through increased insurance premiums or through self-insurance. Yeah, but seriously, right? One of the underlying principles of tort law, it's partially about deterrence. And we think one way to deter negligent action and intentional action, bad action all around, is to make people pay the cost. In fact, if you read anything about product liability, if you read any law review articles written, I don't know, in the past 20 or 30 years about product liability law, this is what it's all about, right? It's about whether or not we efficiently make manufacturers internalize the costs of their decisions, not tax them too much, get right at the optimal amount so that we deter negligence and help provide incentives for efficient, societally beneficial behavior. Okay, so one, this is about deterring wrongdoing, making people be careful. Why else? Yeah.
There's a greater confidence that a sort of centralized bureaucratic system can work instead of allowing it to, I guess, just emerge organically, or as case by case.
In Canada, they have a greater sense that a centralized system could work than here? Is that what you're saying? Versus we think case by case adjudication is probably a better way to get at a result because it allows room for the parties to present evidence about the specific context of their particular injuries as opposed to just a schedule that says, you lost a limb, you used to be a banker, you get... But seriously, right? I make fun of it, but really, that's the thought, right? That we get a better, more accurate result through an individualized adjudication process than we can arrive at through some centralized document schedule. I tell you that we started from the premise that the people in Quebec recover less, something short of the full value of their damages. Might that be a reason why people in the United States are not quick to adopt a system like this? The idea that it's really important to us that victims get full compensation, that the wrongdoer pay the full cost of the harm, and that the victim get full compensation. Well, the court lays all these interests out for you as well, right? Devote some portion of the opinion to talking about why it is that Quebec might have this administrative system. At the end of the day, if Quebec has an administrative system to ensure lower insurance premiums, is that interest furthered by applying Quebec's law to the dispute in Connecticut? Probably not, right? Because we know ultimately that the parties are from Connecticut, and the car was insured in Connecticut. And so whatever damages are assessed against this negligent driver aren't really going to affect insurance premiums in Quebec at all. Same thing, this interest in a quick system of justice that's easier to administer is not really going to be furthered by applying this case in Connecticut, because again, this is this idea, quick justice, cheap justice, that's really for the benefit of the Quebec judicial system, right? In this case, ultimately, it's going to be litigated in Connecticut. On the other hand, if you buy that having a common law system of tort adjudication is really about providing full compensation to the injured party, then it makes some sense to apply that law here, right? Given that Connecticut, the jurisdiction that believes in full compensation for injured victims, is the domicile of the injured party herself. And likewise, if you believe that having a tort system of individual adjudication, one of the benefits of that is to make the wrongdoer pay the costs of the misconduct, again, it looks like that interest is furthered given that the wrongdoer here, the person we're trying to get to act more carefully, is here in Connecticut. And so the court ultimately concludes, hey, in light of that, it looks like there's really only one interest at stake here. It's Connecticut, lo and behold. And so we'll apply our own law. Okay, that looks a lot like what we were talking about at the end of last class. At the end of the day, this court looks at all these Section 6 factors and says, but the only thing that really matters is the interest of the state. And here there's only one state interested, and so we're going to apply that state's law. That's not uncommon, right? That's one thing, that's one way courts might try to grapple with these otherwise amorphous kind of factors there in Section 6. The other ones are nice. They're nice make weights, but what really matters is the interest of the state. And that's what we're going to focus on. Compare that to the second case, Bryant versus Sullivan. Is it Sullivan? Silverman? Bryant versus Silverman. And here you've got a court who really is taking a different approach. You have the court starting from the presumption that it's the law of the state where the injury occurred and that it's supposed to consider these contacts, but then actually trying to apply all those Section 6 factors to figure out what state really has a relationship. Through this a little bit. Where is the place of injury? That's probably the easiest thing to pinpoint here. Where's the place of injury? Yeah. That's where the plane crashes, and so it looks like that's the place of injury. What about where is the domicile of the respective parties in this dispute? A little bit murkier, but Arizona, Texas, Mexico looks like it's about as New Mexico. And the court really focuses in on the Arizona plaintiff and leaves the New Mexico and Texas plaintiff as kind of an afterthought. I think the casebook authors tell you in a note, basically because those plaintiffs didn't really advocate for anything other than Arizona law, and the defendant didn't try to advocate for a New Mexico or Texas law either. And how about where's the relationship centered here? What relationship, by the way, is the court talking about? And I think you could, the relationship between the parties, you could look at this more broadly because there's a couple of relationships between the relevant parties. It's a wrongful death action, so remember these are people, beneficiaries, bringing the action on behalf of someone who's been killed in the car accident to recover damages for their own injuries. So you might talk about the relationship between them and where that's centered, but the court focuses on the relationship between the decedent and the defendant. And since the decedent had purchased the ticket in Colorado, the court says the relationship centered there. And what about the conduct? Yeah.
So the parties are kind of disputing.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a plane crash, and of course the plaintiff's allegation is that the defendant airline failed to properly train the pilots. And so of course their argument is the conduct occurred back in the home state at the home office where the training occurred. On the other hand, the airline's defense is no, we did everything we could, it was pilot error. And of course, if there was a pilot error, that occurred at the crash site in Colorado. Point out, remember I said one of the problems with the first restatement was this potential for kind of endless litigating about factual and legal issues to get to just the choice of law. The second restatement doesn't completely address that problem, right? Because if you really believe that the place of conduct is a significant contact here, You have to figure out what the conduct is in order to figure out where it took place. In order to figure out what the conduct is, you got to figure out, in some extent, who's right about what really happened, right? What is the legally significant conduct? Is it the training of the pilot, or is it what the pilot did in Colorado? So you have that potential, you still have that potential for factual disputes leading into the choice of law question, and that leading into a question about the legal conclusions and getting you in a circle, right? You also have some question, maybe, about the legal issues, the legal liability. Is the airline liable here for pilot error as well as failure to properly train the pilot, or is the airline only liable if it affirmatively failed to train as opposed to if it trained properly and the pilot failed to carry out the instructions? Because again, if we have to identify the place of conduct as a significant contact, we have to know what conduct is relevant legally, right? And we only know what conduct is relevant legally if we know what conduct is relevant legally, which means we need to know the elements of the claim, which kind of means we need to know the choice of law. So there's still this potential, but lucky for the court, it says it doesn't really matter because that's not the determining thing here. We have a dispute about where the conduct is, don't need to talk about it. And then this court, as I said, actually tries to go through these the Section 6 principles and apply them. So as best you can tell, what does it mean when the drafters of the restatement say you need to consider the needs of the interstate and international system? Any idea what that means? I mean, partially I think sometimes that courts don't use these factors because neither the lawyers nor the court can figure out what the drafters were talking about, right? What does that mean? Vaguely familiar, like the shared interest of the sister states, and what is that phrase from the sign?
Is it vaguely just a form? Shopping word, or?
I think in part it is, right? So this is talking about considerations about the way the system, the court systems, can function harmoniously. And one of the potential concerns is the potential for forum shopping and the fact that all states, whatever their substantive tort law might be, we all think that forum shopping is a bad thing. And presumably, we would all be willing to give a little bit on our individual policy interests in any given case to prevent forum shopping. That would be one of the things. The court here talks about also ensuring interstate harmony in terms of the facilitation of commercial transactions. Again, the idea that whatever one state's given interest, policy interest might be, it might be willing to just kind of subjugate that a little bit to another state's interest in the interest of better interstate commercial transactions. That's the idea the drafters had in mind when they talk about this idea of interstate, international systems. Okay, we looked a little bit. Protection of justified expectations. The idea of whatever any given state's interest might be in a dispute, it is good in and of itself to try to protect the interest of the litigants. And good in the system, in the idea of fostering good interstate commercial transactions, because think about this. The extent to which the parties can better on the front end have some expectation about what their potential liability is downstream, the easier it is for them to enter into interstate transactions. If I told you that you have no, if you enter into a contract with a party from New Mexico, you would have no way to anticipate, you know, willy-nilly, the court might apply Mexican law, might apply Ohio law, might apply New Zealand law, who knows? But if you only enter into contracts domestically that you know only Ohio law would apply, that might provide a disincentive to enter into commercial transactions with other parties outside of the state because you just don't know, right? There. If even if it's like you can't even anticipate what law might apply, it would make it difficult for you to enter into those out-of-state transactions. So that idea of protecting justified expectations, somewhat similar to this idea of certainty, predictability, and uniformity, that's a good thing. Again, in and of itself, it's a good thing. right? We think that the same case ought to be resolved the same way, regardless of whether you file it in New Mexico or Ohio or New Zealand, but also because it prevents form shopping, or at least reduces the likelihood of form shopping. And then ease and determination and application law to be applied. Remember the very first day we talked about not wanting to consume a whole lot of litigation resources on just figuring out what law applies and how to apply it. And we want the courts to ultimately apply whatever law it is correctly. If you think about those factors, those are things that are looking outside, externally. Or if you want to think about this another way, I said last time, one of the things about Curie's interest analysis, his simple idea, which was revolutionary, was this idea that it didn't matter that something was a conflicts case. It didn't matter that something was multi-state. Ultimately, the court was just interpreting two statutes and doing the same thing it did in the domestic context. The fact that the contacts were across state lines was irrelevant. Those are internal, right? That's trying to impose a sense of internal order on conflicting statutes. These other principles, they're inconsistent with that, right? They're a contradiction. For these principles, you only need to consider the concerns of the interstate system, the expectations of the parties to some extent, if it is a multi-state case. And so those are about trying to impose some sense of external order on a system of conflicts beyond just resolving internally the case at hand. I think that's also why sometimes courts don't want to deal with that. They just want to look at those internal factors about interest as opposed to trying to look conversely or externally at these other factors. Okay, so this is the case where the court actually does try to do that, though. Tries to look outward, tries to look at all of these factors, including those universal factors. So the court ultimately concludes here, why is it that applying Arizona law will further the needs of the interstate and international system? Yeah. So think about this logic. The court says, by the way, I didn't ask you, but everybody clear, what's the difference between Arizona and Colorado law that the parties are really fighting about here? Money, and money in what respect? I mean, obviously, yeah, they're always fighting about the base amount of money, but what about the...
In Colorado, it looks like the wrongful death, the damages and wrongful death are limited, whereas...
And everybody pick up on how they're limited. In Colorado, the plaintiff is entitled to recover pecuniary losses only, which means what? Well, punitives are actually a separate issue. Again, a little background about remedies. Generally, compensatory damages, the purpose of compensatory damages and the sole measure of compensatory damages is compensating the plaintiff for actual harms she suffers and giving her money that approximates the value of those harms. Punitive damage, and generally speaking too, it is once the defendant's liable on some level, it's irrelevant how bad the defendant was. Regardless of whether the defendant was negligent, careless, reckless or intentional and mean, the defendant is liable for the full value of the actual harms that the plaintiff suffers. That's compensatory damages. Now, think about within those harms, the types of harms, injuries, people suffer. The beneficiaries of the decedents here, what would be some of the actual harms they would suffer? Okay, if the decedent is the primary or principal or exclusive breadwinner providing all the financial support to the family, they lose that income. Even if it just contributes marginally, they lose the marginal value of the financial support. In my family, of course, the bigger contribution would be, my husband's not here, I can say it, child care. I provide all of the great child care services we have in our family, and so if I were not available, he'd have to hire a nanny, and that would cost him money. That's a loss, a harm, right? Beyond it, if they had to pay medical expenses or funeral expenses for the deceased, that might be a harm that these guys suffer. Beyond that, what else might they? What other types of harms might these people suffer?
Yeah. Beyond that, they have the loss of society, companionship, relationship, that intangible or non-economic or non-pecuniary loss that they suffer when their loved one dies. Okay, that's the difference between Colorado and Arizona law. Colorado law says you can only recover pecuniary, those financial harms, those economic harms, like the lost wages, like the lost value of household services, like the medical expenses and funeral expenses you had to pay for. In contrast, Arizona says you get those, plus you get some damages for those intangible or non-economic harms. Again, that's just to compensate for actual harms. Beyond that, punitive damages go beyond that. They give money to a plaintiff, divorced from plaintiff's harms. They give money to a plaintiff because we think that the defendant's conduct was so outrageous or so egregious that we should impose a penalty to punish the defendant for doing something really bad, and also to provide, hopefully, a strong deterrent so that the defendant and others won't act the same way in the future. And I might add as an aside, when we're talking about that, what the defendant did and why the defendant did it and how the defendant did it does matter, right? So now, the defendant was negligent, not so much. If the defendant was reckless, maybe we're getting warm. If the defendant was intentional and intentionally causing harm, now we're going to impose punitive damages, and we'll even try to assess the culpability of the defendant, right? How bad the defendant was in setting the amount. Arizona says punitives are great. Wrongful death action, survival action, personal injury action, doesn't matter. Right? If the defendant was bad enough, we impose punitive damages. On the other hand, Colorado says no, not in wrongful death actions. Okay, so right away, the court's got two different issues to grapple with here. And the answer doesn't have to be the same. It could be that Arizona law applies to redress one of these or address one of these issues, and Colorado law applies to address the other. It could be Arizona law applies to both, Colorado law applies to both. The court's got to look at both of these things. Now, back to my original question, how is it or why is it that the court thinks that applying Arizona law will actually further the interstate and international systems, the interests of the interstate and international systems? Again, how is that, in what way does that promote the interstate interest? You're right, that's what the court says. And the court's got this idea. At the end of the day, while it's true Colorado doesn't allow wrongful death plaintiffs to recover all of their losses, it allows wrongful death plaintiffs to recover some pecuniary losses. So Colorado must be interested on some level in deterring bad conduct, right? Otherwise, they just say, no wrongful death recovery, no injury, no personal injury recovery at all. Too bad, so sad, right? But they don't, they allow some. And not only that, because they allow some, they're clearly also interested in compensating the injuries. Okay, so, and beyond that, policies underlying a particular field of law, we all know from first year law school, torts as a big thing, regardless of whether you're talking about Arizona, Colorado, or Ohio, tort law is interested in these two things, deterring negligent action and providing compensation to injured parties. And so applying Arizona law furthers everybody's interest, right? It's a win-win. We're furthering compensation returns, albeit a little more than Colorado would like to do, but we are, right? To go a little beyond. And we get this added bonus. Wow, now if you fly an airplane anywhere near Arizona, apparently, like as in the entire western half of the United States, you ought to know to be really, really careful not to be negligent, because we're going to enforce our idea about what we deter and to what extent we deter negligent conduct. And that's good for Colorado, too, because after all, if you're in Colorado, who wouldn't want to get on a plane that's going to be flown extra safe? And so, voila, the needs of the interstate system and the basic policies of the field have been advanced just by applying Arizona law. Very good. All right. They have to do that because if you actually look at the relevant policies here, is Arizona interested? Is Colorado interested in this dispute? Let's talk a little bit about why it is, you think, that Arizona might allow all recovery, recovery even for those intangible or non-economic losses, whereas Colorado might not. Or maybe it's easier to think about it in terms of why Colorado might not allow recovery. And Colorado is not alone, by the way. Other jurisdictions limit recovery to pecuniary losses only in wrongful death cases. Why do you think that might be? And in fact, the whole tort movement is founded on trying to limit personal injury damages in that respect.
Is it the economics of Colorado, like dangerous occupations, or, I mean, historically, would they be more exposed?
Maybe, right, because there's mining. But, you know, I don't know about Arizona, I mean. But take that a little bit further. Why do you think it is? Because if the history and the economics are such that there are people working in more dangerous occupations in Colorado, why that might, in turn, translate to the state limiting recovery in wrongful death actions. Yeah.
Because it would be better for business.
In what way is it better for business?
By limiting your damages, they're not going to have to pay out as
okay, so there's the base idea, and the court articulates that too, that you just want to protect the defendants from big verdicts, from excess liability. So for sure, that's at work here. Now, the court doesn't talk about it, but be a little bit more thoughtful. Why carve out this part? Because as I said, Colorado could just say, no wrongful death recovery. Remember, I said, that's not a right that existed at common law, that's a creature of statute. So you could easily say, no recovery. You could say, prove up all your damages and you get half. If what you really want to do is just protect defendants from large verdicts, or you could say, I don't care what your damages are, you get $10,000. Or you get the lesser of your full damages and $10,000. But they haven't said pecuniary losses only, which I agree will have the effect of limiting recovery.
Because wrongful death action is inherently emotional and juries might get carried away and award higher non-economic damages.
Okay, there's at least the belief that pecuniary losses are better anchored, the value of them are better anchored to real measurable things. We know what your doctor bills were. We know how much your husband used to make, and we know what percentage of that is in your bank account. We know how much it will cost to hire another nanny. On the other hand, wow, you're really sad and you're going to be devastated because you will not have your husband's companionship for the rest of your life. We all know that's really bad and that would hurt, but how much is that worth? There's no anchor there. And so as a result of that, we think because the jury will feel really bad for you and you'll see a really wealthy defendant, who cares if they have to pay out a few extra bucks, will shift more money your way. Even beyond that, because there is no anchor, again, this concern about certainty and predictability, right? Not only can the defendant be liable for a lot of money, but the defendant has no really good way on the front end, or the insurance company on the front end, has no really good way to predict how much money that'll be, and so can't predict how much money it needs to place in reserve to make sure that it has that amount of money in the event it has to pay out. And so, we'll err on the side of caution and either not provide insurance to you or provide insurance at a greater cost. Defendant, because can't predict the risk, will either provide services to consumers within the state at a really high cost or not at all. And so maybe that's the reason for capping at pecuniary, balanced on the other side with again, because those pecuniary harms are measurable, we can see in a visceral way that the plaintiff really suffered them, right? If we just cut her damages in half, she's gonna walk away owing money to someone. Versus when we can really see the money she's out of her pocket, we feel better like giving her that. We feel like we have to give her that so that she's not behind. Okay, maybe that's happening. On the other hand, why allow, as Arizona does, allow a plaintiff to recover everything, including non-economic damages? I'm just motivated by the opposite, right? Concern about full compensation and recognition that those really are true harms the plaintiff suffers, just like those economic harms, and we want to make sure that the plaintiff receives full compensation. Really true, and the court kind of acknowledges that it is true, although not completely, kind of acknowledges it. Is Arizona interested in having Arizona law apply to this dispute? Sure, right? Because after all, at the end of the day, the beneficiaries who've been harmed are in Arizona. And certainly, to the extent that Arizona is interested in seeing anybody receive full compensation, it ought to be Arizona residents. Beyond that, to the extent we think that the plaintiffs need full compensation in order to kind of actually be able to pay all their economic losses, those creditors who are owed the money from the plaintiff, they're likely in Arizona too, right? That's likely where the funeral expenses were incurred. That's likely where any medical expenses, although it looks like there weren't any in these cases because the plaintiffs were, the deceased were killed instantaneously. That's likely where those are incurred. And we want to make sure that those Arizona creditors get paid. Do that. Now, on the other hand, if I'm right, what Colorado's really interested in doing is not just protecting defendants from excess verdicts, but protecting defendants from excess verdicts in a particular way to ensure some predictability and certainty in what liability will be for wrongful conduct. Does Colorado have an interest in having its law apply? So I want to come back to this notion about the economics of Colorado. I don't know whether or not historically Colorado has a lot of people employed in dangerous fields, but I do know one thing about Colorado. It's a great place to go skiing in the winter, and it's a great place to go biking in the summer. There's two things about Colorado. What do you think is one of the prime industries supporting the Colorado economy? Not the only for sure, but don't you think tourism is a big part of the Colorado economy? Okay. If you're a Colorado legislator and you know that a lot of the revenue that your state sees comes from tourists coming into your state to go skiing and to go biking and to go wherever else they want to go in the beautiful outdoor world of Colorado, what's really important to make that happen?
Make sure that companies providing transportation.
You need to make sure. Hey, it's great that Colorado residents visit Colorado. It's great that people in New Mexico and Arizona and Utah might drive to Colorado, but you really need airplanes to fly people into Colorado from places like Ohio and New York and even sometimes Arizona, it turns out, right? Because that's what keeps the tourism industry going. The fact that you've got transportation, and you want those entities to continue to provide those transportation services and provide them at a cost that's accessible. Okay, that I suspect might have been motivating, to the extent that anything was motivating the legislators, that might have been motivating the legislators to limit recovery and limit it to pecuniary losses only. If that's true, if that it's really about protecting defendants, but protecting defendants so that they continue to provide low-cost services to consumers in Colorado and also to consumers who come into Colorado to take advantage of Colorado businesses, then does Colorado have an interest in applying its law in this case? For sure. But The court is a bit disingenuous when it tells you Colorado's interest here is in protecting Colorado corporations, and so we don't need to worry. Because ultimately that's what Colorado's interested in, making sure everybody who does business in the state continues to do business and do business in an affordable way. And so maybe, just maybe, Colorado really is interested. But the court says, no, no, only one interested jurisdiction. Now think about that. If that's true, what does that also say about what will really further the needs of the interstate and international system? Is it fair to say, eh, everybody's interested in compensation, so we're kind of furthering the interstate system and the interest both states have in facilitating interstate transactions if we just apply a little bit more rigorous tort law? Probably not, right? That's probably a little bit of disingenuous reasoning on the court's part. Seems that Colorado's idea of facilitating interstate transactions is quite the opposite, right? Allowing for more limited liability so that companies continue to do business and provide business to entities. You got the same problem when it comes, by the way, I also kind of say a little bit about make the same types of criticisms. The court also just kind of very quickly says, at the end of the day, you know, certainty, predictability, uniformity, result, justified expectations don't really matter so much. I think if you think about that, that's a little disingenuous too, right? It seems like justified expectations are a big part about what's animating the tort law here, or at least Colorado's desire to protect expectations and the hopes that SunWest has done business here on those expectations. So I think you gotta go play a little faster loose to get to the court's conclusion that those things don't really matter in a tort case. They would matter in a contract case, not a tort case. Now, on the other hand, can you make some arguments that it could have been within the defendant's expectations here that Arizona law would apply? Sure. I mean, on the one hand, you can say, well, the defendant's flying in Colorado and it ought to expect that Colorado law would apply. On the other hand, the defendant chose to incorporate in Arizona, right? And you can say, if the defendant chose to incorporate in Arizona for some reason that was to benefit the defendant, then the defendant ought to justifiably expect that he might be subject to some of the burdens of that choice as well, like a more rigorous tort law. Maybe. But to say that it just doesn't apply, I think, is a little bit disingenuous. Anyway, so you get all the way through, and the court here, with a little bit of funny business, is able to say that it thinks Arizona law should apply. You know, the court doesn't really address punitive damages in depth as a separate issue, but does it raise separate concerns? Maybe. So back to my question, why is it, do you think, that Colorado might not allow punitive damages in wrongful death actions? Some of the concerns are likely the same, right? Limiting, protecting defendants from excess liability, protecting defendants from excess liability when, on the flip side, we don't think the plaintiff has suffered any harms that aren't being compensated, protecting defendants in particular from punitive liability because it's not anchored to objectively measurable harms. We think it's susceptible to uncertain, if not inflated, awards. It makes it hard for the defendant to predict liability on the front end, procure insurance on the front end, and so that might be why. In which case, again, pretty good argument that Colorado is perhaps interested, and that it really isn't in the interest of interstate harmony to allow Arizona to say to everybody in the entire western half of the United States, we will influence airfares for all of them. You might also, when it gets to this conduct question, you might also ask if whether you're talking about wrongful death damages or punitive damages affects what conduct is relevant. Because remember, I told you the thing about punitive damages is it really matters how bad the defendant was, as opposed to not so much for the wrongful death actions in general. Regardless of what the defendant's liability might be for the pilot's error in Colorado, the defendant's liability for punitive damages might very much depend on what the defendant did in Arizona. do your utmost to train your pilots. Have great instruction, great supervision, great systems of accountability, and every now and then, pilot error will occur. And while you might be liable for compensatory damages for that, not liable for punitive damages. On the other hand, if you haven't maybe been so accountable, right, haven't had good training systems in place, haven't enforced them, haven't monitored them, haven't had a system of accountability, then maybe you should be liable for punitive damages. So that maybe you answer the conduct question differently depending on whether you're talking about punitive damages or willful death damages, and maybe then that ultimately affects how you weigh the context. In fact, maybe you have a stronger case for applying Arizona law with respect to the punitive damages because the conduct in Arizona will have more relevance to that claim than it does to the underlying wrongful death claim. Anyway, walk you through all of this to hopefully have you see, first of all, an example of how a court can actually try to apply these factors, but also, more importantly, to kind of open your eyes to the fact that as much as I like to criticize the first restatement and all the potential for judicial funny business, right, with the application manipulation of the rules, interest analysis, the restatement, and interest analysis in general is susceptible to some of the same criticisms, just on a different level, right? The judges here are able to manipulate what they identify as the interests behind the competing laws and the competing jurisdictions to achieve a result, to find a way to say that applying Arizona's law ultimately won't interfere too much with any interest Colorado has. You can only achieve that if you disregard the fact that Colorado doesn't just have an interest in compensating, but has struck a particular balance between compensation and encouraging business that is different from the balance that Arizona set. And applying Arizona law upsets that balance. You only get there if you disregard part of what's going on. And so, it's not a foolproof system, subject to manipulation as well. But ask yourself as you go through and you read these cases, given that limitation, right, even though you know it's there, does it still produce a better result? Is it still better to have this potential manipulation in the system than the manipulation at work in the first restatement, where we're arguing about whether something's a tort or a contract, whether something's substance versus procedure, without untethered from the purposes behind those particular provisions? Questions? Yeah, I disagree with that. Okay. I think they kind of did. I mean, in my mind, but.
And so, well, I guess my question is, basically, it's only just one of them to relate these principles to.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what the overarching criticism is that the restatement itself doesn't overtly explain, take the context, analyze them side by side, and this is how you should do it, right? And I think that's more what the criticism is. But I think the court here, in order to apply these factors, it has to consider these contexts. It's almost as if the critics are looking for, here's the hierarchy of these contexts, and the restatement doesn't give you that. I think that's perhaps an unfair criticism. I think the court really is connecting. Any other questions? All right. Well, I'll leave you a few minutes early. We'll see you next week.